True Consequences is a proud member of the Borealis Podcasters Guild.
The Oracle Network.
True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I'm your host, Eric Carter Lundeen. All right, we are live. I want to, first of all, say thank you so much to Dr. Ashley Wellman, Dr. Jules for joining me. It is extremely early where Dr. Jules is on the other side of the globe. And for some reason, I just picked the worst possible time to have this, but thank you for being a good sport.
Always no problem.
So welcome, everybody. Before we jump right into this, hey, Fern, let's see here. We've got some people saying hi here, so we'll throw those up there. Hello. I need to give a couple of shout outs to some people. I need to say thank you so much to my newest patron subscribers. I've got Yolanda. I've got Melissa. Thank you very much to the people that have donated to my Ko-fi account. Thank you for all of the good reviews, and the explosion of followers and listeners over the last week has been absolutely insane. I'm super, super grateful. If you don't know, Dr. Jules and Dr. Ashley both did a couple parts with Robin from The Trail Went Cold about Jacob's case on the Riddle Me That podcast. I think there's maybe another part or two coming out still, an interview with me. So go check out Dr. Jules' podcast. Go follow both of these amazing women on social media. They are incredible. And Dr. Ashley and I spent some time this morning kind of engaging with people, Twitter trolls. So God, that was bless. Fun.
Well, yeah, I hope they're watching. This will be good. This will be an educational event for everybody. And thanks, Eric, for having us. It's awesome to collaborate with such a warrior. I'm just incredibly proud of you. And you're a big inspiration to a lot of families. So thank you for having us on.
That's really sweet. Thank you. Dr. Jules, you will be able to talk, but she's kind of freezing a little bit. So if you notice that she looks a little bit frozen, it's because she is. Her internet bandwidth is struggling to keep up with the video. So I think we can still hear you, though, Dr. Jules.
Yeah, I'm here live. I'm not a mannequin.
She's beautiful either way. So incredibly brilliant. So it's going to be great.
This is like a I'm not a cat moment that we're having.
Yeah,
here.
Exactly. Yeah. You're live. I'm not a mannequin.
I am here. I'm not a cat.
I'm not a cat. So I brought you folks here to join me to talk about something that popped up automatically because of Kendall Ray's massive success and her highlighting Jacob's story. There was a lot of interesting comments that were directed at myself and my mom. And it was frustrating for me. Because I'm very attached to Jacob's case. It's my life. It's my life story. And maybe my perspective might be a little bit skewed because of that. But I just wanted to get some voices of reason here to talk through this with me, because I was very frustrated with the amount of people that kept saying things like, the mom needs to go to jail. The mom deserves this. This is all her fault. When I say the mom, I mean my mom. And I'm very protective of my mother. You know, we went through hell together. We faced some of the worst things imaginable together, and we came out the other side. And so I don't blame my mom. You know, my mom was a victim of this person, this narcissistic abuser's manipulation, his gaslighting, his game playing, and really the level of mental games that he played with us, you know, it still sticks with me. I still have lingering issues related to all of that. So I wanted to talk to you both about, first of all, let's talk about domestic violence. Let's talk about the prevalence of that and what it does to people. And then I want to talk about why people want to blame somebody for another person's actions.
Yeah. So I am a victimologist by trade. So I'm actually a professor of criminology and victimology. And so I, when I teach, I always teach with the perspective of looking at these cases from the survivor's point of view. And also the impact of what you just said, Eric, the way society and individuals respond to those cases and to those individuals is forever life-changing. Mm-hmm. And from law enforcement, right? And now we are getting much better. But even historically, law enforcement saying things like, we've responded once, we're not going back to that home. If a mother doesn't want to leave, if a father, because men are also victims of domestic violence, doesn't want to leave, if somebody doesn't want to protect their kids, you know, they're 17, they can get out, then it's on them, right? And society isn't far behind that argument. In fact, I think law enforcement has progressed where society hasn't. And we have all of these myths that we keep perpetuating, right? That say exactly what survivors do to themselves. It's that I caused this. I'm responsible for this. I'm not able to get out of this because of the things their abuser have said to them, that you're weak, that you're worthless, that you don't have any skills, that no one will love you, right? That I'll kill you when you leave. And so, you know, I'll let Jules jump in, but I mean, I could talk to you for hours just about the whole cycle and why when people say she should have left, meaning your mother, right? Your mother did exactly what she could do. She survived. And now you and your mom are thriving together, right? And that's the best people can do in that situation is mom survived and you survived with her. And now you guys are thriving. So, you know, I'm going to turn it to Jules, but I can't wait to talk about like why all of that is just horse crap and why it's really the reason that we're in this situation as a society anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really unfortunate that that is the conversation that we have to have because it seems to be such a prevalent narrative, especially with regards to true crime. And we've seen it this week with what you've dealt with after the Kendall Ray episode and all of the blowback that you've gotten from that and all of the victim blaming that's been basically put on the shoulders of your mother. And it is an incredibly unfair narrative. There's a thing called a just world hypothesis, and it's something where everybody believes that we get what we deserve. So this is something where it's also a defense mechanism in which people will kind of try to distance themselves and going, well, you know, that person deserved it. You know, we kind of get what we deserve. Things happen for a reason, karma, all of those sorts of things are kind of attributed to the individual. And then we also have something at play called the attribution error, where we attribute all of the blame to the individual that is the victim. Whereas it should be considered that, you know, the perpetrator or the offender in these cases has a certain amount of agency. And so that person is the one who's choosing with their very free will to perpetrate these acts of violence or murder or rape, whatever, you know, crime you're considering. They make these choices and, you know, they put that out into the world rather than looking at the victim and going, well, she continued to come back to this violent relationship. Therefore, she deserved what she got. Or she wore a short skirt, therefore she deserved to be raped.
And here's what's crazy is that people act like I entered this relationship and he slapped me in the face or right. He kicked my child in front of me, right? And that's right. Like, oh, now let's date, right? I like that. Mm-hmm. So Eric, today, you know, my blood got boiling a little bit and I tried to be very kind and supportive because I think when people speak out, maybe they're willing to listen, right? But to say that there has to be empathy for people who are in these situations, because I myself, when I was very young, was with a very abusive human being. Didn't start like that. I'm a very educated, intelligent woman, right? I come from a great family. I know what my worth is. So I date a man who's funny, right? Super great. Everyone likes him. But years into it, right? This human that I've trusted for years starts becoming different types of abuse, right? People think, well, it's all physical. It's not. Emotional abuse, right? Belittling you just a little bit at a time, right? And at first you're like, well, that was kind of mean, but he's a good guy, right? Mm-hmm. And as it goes, right, that emotional abuse starts getting a little deeper and the next cuts a little deeper, but you rationalize and you go back to this idea of not me, one, and two, right? That's not the man I love. That's not the woman I love who's hurting me. And then you take into account financial, you know, dependency and abuse where maybe we share an account. Maybe I don't have a bank account, right? Maybe my check goes to my husband. Then you have things like cyber abuse, which is a new thing we're learning about where they have access to my controls. They email my work. They harass me that way, hurt my children, right? Physical abuse, sexual abuse, all of that becomes this huge wheel where you, years into a relationship, right? Or after trauma, which mom experienced, right? Mm-hmm. That needing that feeling of love and acceptance, people know that, predators know that. Yeah. And they say, she's vulnerable, right? I'm going to bond with her, gain her trust, and slowly but surely, I'm going to chip away to where she finds herself lost. And in this place where family's not supporting, right? I don't have financial dependency. I don't have the skills. So the people who say just leave, and how did you get into that relationship in the first place? Because you were vulnerable and you trusted it. And that's what everyone does in a relationship.
Right.
And then it's too dark and you don't know how to get out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from my perspective, you know, for me, it hurts to see that because like I said, I'm very protective of my mom. I know that she was horribly abused. Mm-hmm. You know, she had no idea what was happening to me because I did not tell her. Mm-hmm. I did not share that information with her because I was protecting her and I was mm-hmm. protecting me mm-hmm. because I was told that if I said anything, we would both die. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there were a lot of comments of people saying things like, well, she should have known that that was happening to you. And there is no possible way she could have known because first of all, she wasn't there when it happened. And I acted like nothing was wrong. Like
now, but you're putting the responsibility on you. The reality is your abuser made sure that mom did not know, right? How old were you? Tell listeners who don't know your story. How old were you when you were being abused?
I was, when the sexual abuse started, I was probably 10.
Right. So you said, you know, like, I didn't tell her. It wasn't your, that you're like, you're, I leave you of your responsibility of that, right? As a little boy being hurt by an abuser who made sure that the situation allowed for a place where you did not have a voice, right? Mm-hmm. He stole that from you. So that's again on him. And he made sure that your mother wasn't in the situation so that she couldn't be your voice. And so I leave you of that responsibility. You could not have told mom. You didn't have the voice and your abuser did that to you. Like, that's what happened.
And we have to remember, too, that, you know, any sort of abuser, and, you know, we use the pseudonym John, right? So in this case, this abuser, he effectively isolated you and your mother from your support network. Your mother didn't have any friends to go to. You had a family in which talking about your feelings and talking about trauma wasn't an option. So what kind of outlet did she potentially have? She had none. And he even went so far as to punish you both if you guys made eye contact. So he severed whatever support and ties that the two of you had together. So neither one of you had an outlet or a safe space to go to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think you get in that survival mechanism. You know, it comes to a point where the abuse is so bad, you think like, I just have to survive this. I have to make sure that no one is like so hurt. Do you know what I mean? That we're just surviving. Like I get another breath and I can navigate that. And in that abusive state, there's such helplessness and such fear and such isolation and shame. I mean, the shame is horrific for someone who is a victim. We shame ourselves. Like we don't need society to shame people, right? Victims and survivors shame themselves enough. And that's what holds us shackled in those abusive relationships is the fear of speaking out and having someone say, then just leave. Well, you're choosing to be there, right? And it's like, well, there goes my lifeline that I was reaching for, you know? And people listening, what's hard to imagine is that on average, it takes 7 times to leave an abusive relationship, 7 attempts to leave. And it is the most dangerous time in an individual's life. Homicide rates during someone trying to leave an abusive relationship go through the roof. Because think about big incidents, right, that we think about when we think of panic and trauma and horror, like Jim Jones, right? When he mm-hmm. lost control, 900 and some odd people died. So all abusers have that same trigger mechanism, right? As long as I have control and I'm the puppet master, we're all okay, right? But when you get the strength to walk out, you now have that abuser has lost control. You're at high risk of being tracked down and killed. Or when you come back to get something because, you know, he's apologized from that cycle of abuse, right? The honeymoon phase, the normal phase, the tension phase, the blow up phase, and then there's flowers again, right? Mm-hmm. And you're back, you're killed. I mean, there's a very high rate of that. And so people so lightly say, just leave. People do try to leave. right? They do try to, absolutely, highest risk when someone's, you know, pregnant. Absolutely, right? You're not taking my baby and I'm going to keep control of all of these things. LGBTQ community, even higher violence when there's this attempt to leave. So just leave. I mean, that makes me so mad.
Well, I think, go ahead, Dr. Jules.
I was just going to say, it's so reductive to say and so simplistic, and it's a way of distancing oneself. And again, a defense mechanism. I would never be in this situation. I would never allow this to happen to me. But the very reality is, speaking to what you spoke to, Ashley, is, you know, I've also been in a situation like that when I was in my early 20s, mm-hmm. and it starts out slowly. It starts out with, you know, gaslighting, coercive control, and it did get to a point where it was physical near the end, mm-hmm. but it took me, you know, 3 years to get out of this relationship, and it's like the frog in the pot of boiling water. If you mm-hmm. toss them in, they jump out, but if you slowly bring that water to a boil, they stay in, and they boil, and they die, right? Yes. And that is a really decent analogy when it comes to describing domestic violence situations, because once you're in it, you can't see the forest through the trees. Like, no. You can't see anything. You've got no clarity or objectivity.
Yeah. And you're really doing that. What's my next step just to survive? And I remember for me, it was very much this idea of protecting my family image as a Southern girl, especially, right? That I was raised so differently than the way I was being treated. And I remember, thinking, well, I made my bed, I'm going to lie in it. And I've got to figure out a way to get out of this. And you're like, how did I get so deep? But when we walked out, life is great. We're perfect, right? And so people didn't know how to help or intervene. I didn't let them, right? Because I didn't want them to think the victim. I was studying victimology at the PhD level. Like, what? And I remember sitting in class and like, oh my God, this, like, I'm living the abuse wheel. Like, that's what I'm doing, right? We have a great 30 minutes. I remember I could quantify good times, right? We had a good 30 minutes. That was good. And then the tension starts, and then there's an explosion, and then there's this kind of like quiet period, and then this, I'm so sorry, I've never hit somebody before, right? I've never called people names before. You make me so mad and crazy. It's your fault, right? And then I'm thinking like, God, I should watch myself, and then we'd be happy, you know? And then it would go back around, and I'd get flowers and apologies. And so it took my mom saying, you're incredibly skinny. You're not the same woman I thought you were. Like, would your daughter be safe? Like, if you had a child with this person, would they be safe, right? I don't have children then. And I remember saying, like, keep your mouth shut. You don't know my life. And then I remember crying and saying, I need out. Yeah. And it was like a mass exodus to get out. But it took years for that to happen.
It's a very subtle brainwash. And it's like you said, Dr. Jules, it's a slow burn. You're not immediately immersed in all of this. And so I think it's important for people to know, with my mom, this is my cousin here.
Donovan's your cousin?
Donovan.
Yeah. Donovan, I agree. Mom is amazing. Eric's amazing. There's no guilt to be having there. Absolutely.
With Jacob, there was no clear evidence that anything, you know, it was suspicious, yes. But this person is known as a kind, generous, mm-hmm. loving, very engaging type person that people want to be around. He's charismatic, right? Mm-hmm. And so nobody thought he was capable of what he did behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought that.
So if mom had really said, like, guys, you know, this is happening, there become these conversations. Like, I've had pastors tell people, you know, like, well, you're married, you really need to work this out, that he's a good man, she's a good woman, right? And there is this push in society to say, surely that's not happening, right? And encouragement to let good relationships, ones that do appear to have promise. And he was helping your family in this critical time. So he was the white knight, the hero. Everyone was like, oh, mom's in good hands. This is finally the kind of family that she deserves. And behind closed doors, it's very different. But even when you ask for help a lot of times, right, or you allude to help, you're put back kind of in this place of like, well, make it work. Right? Mm-hmm. You guys can make it work, or you've made a commitment to one another, or he's helping you financially. So maybe you should, you know, work on that. And so I don't know that people can ever understand what's happening behind closed doors. And then to add the layer of shame and stigma that society helps us create, right, keeps that door even tighter closed, then people are unable to get help.
I think that John is the very personification of that nice guy predator. So you don't have just a guy that grooms individuals like he did, you know, with you. He tried to do with your cousin. We've got an individual who's not only grooming children. We've got an individual who's grooming an entire community, right? And, you know, FBI ex-profiler Jim Clemente speaks on this a lot. And he speaks about these people. And they are exactly like that. The ones that the community will jump to defend and go, he would not do this because he's a nice guy. He's a supportive guy. He's everything that you want out of, you know, X, Y, or Z, you know, a pastor, a baseball coach, whatever it is. He personifies that. And he did a great job because he had all of these people jumping to his defense saying, that's not him. He's not the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're all capable of things that don't really come out in our professional title or in our demeanor with friends and family. Because like I said, it's easy to put on an act. But and someone said it's changed since the 80s. It has changed, right? Chris Watts, what a perfect family, right? The perfect family. But a lot was happening behind closed doors there. But you did see a big difference. 70s, 80s, there was a door completely closed, you know, even 90s on the family home. And then we've seen victims' rights movements. We've seen more understanding, more survivors coming forward and being advocates for the community. And so that door to our home has opened some, right? And things like child abuse, spousal abuse, you know, those types of things, they are getting more attention and shedding more light on it. But it takes time and it takes society responding differently and giving survivors a space to exist and to let go of shame and stigma.
Yeah, I think that is a huge part of this. You know, part of the reason why there's not a lot of understanding about this topic is because it's so difficult to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, it took me 30 years to start openly discussing this, to have this conversation, because it is absolutely horrifying. And there's a lot, like you said, a lot of shame that you carry on your own, even though, you know I didn't do anything wrong in the scenario. I was a kid. I still have a lot of shame and guilt and all the stuff that I have to work through. I still have that thinking in my mind of how I'm going to present myself to the rest of the world, and how I'm going to be a good person by changing how I speak and changing, you know, how I interact with people, because I don't want people to think, you know, certain things about me. And so all of that kind of brainwashing is still there. On top of that, I'm still trying to deal with all the trauma that happened, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and that's I think that's a lifelong journey. I think when, you know, it's not something that heals overnight. What happened to you on many levels, right? You are a survivor of so many different types of abuses, sexual abuse, physical abuse, the you know, being a survivor of the murder of your brother. I mean, it's like, in the abuse of your mother, like witnessing those things alone, each isolated event would be a lifelong struggle. What you have going for you is that not only are you an advocate for others, but you are advocating for changing the dialogue, which I think long-term helps you. It also wears you out. So make sure you practice self-care, because I know that's one of those things that as we share our own personal stories, right? It costs, emotional cost. But I just am so grateful. Don't watch the only reason you need to watch what you say is so others feel safe around you, but don't watch what you say, because you, Eric, as a man, are just an amazing human. You know, every broken little piece that you feel makes it one big, beautiful package. So you own that story and you're changing the way other survivors are looking at you when you're most vulnerable and broken and saying like, holy hell, that's a survivor. Like, I want to be like that. And then you have our trolls that we can, Jules and I will help you address. But overall, I think when survivors start to own their story and they embrace their brokenness, it's like, what a gorgeous legacy, you know? And this talk alone, I hear people saying, thank you for talking about it, right? It's just saying the reason we feel shame is because people don't talk about it. Miscarriages, abuse, you know, death, all of the things that make society uncomfortable. We just got to start talking about it and let people see that we're all broken somehow and still somehow really beautiful too.
You guys are going to make me cry.
Don't cry. You're just great. Own it.
Yeah. Eric, you're honestly such a survivor, and it's so beautiful. And in doing our interview, you know, it's something I never really talked about, but I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse as well. And it's something that brought a great deal of shame, and it's something that has been a great deal of trauma that I've had to spend, you know, my life working through as well. And it does, as you'd said in our interview, affect every single relationship and have this ripple effect throughout my life, right? You don't just say goodbye to it. And it's the same with, you know, domestic violence and those sorts of situations. We deal with it every single day, and you've been such a great advocate for Jacob, and you've been so strong in speaking out against, you know, these people that are judging you in a situation and judging your mother for a situation that you are blameless. You are a victim. Your mother is a victim. All of the onus should be on the perpetrator or the offender, John, because that's exactly where we need to put blame. And, you know, the really unfortunate thing is, in doing some research, I found that these two women who are doing a lot of research with regards to victim blaming, Niemi is at Harvard. She's doing postdoctoral work in psychology, and Young is from Boston College. She's a professor of psychology, and they found that a victim-centric narrative, it invites more victim blaming, unfortunately. So they don't know why necessarily, but they know mostly because it's a defense mechanism. But us humans want somewhere to put the blame. So we go, oh, well, you know, it's their fault. But a perpetrator or offender-centered narrative, we're less likely to victim blame. But I think in the true crime space, we are trying to transition more towards the victims and the survivors, and to make that, you know, a point that we really focus on, rather than making it all about Ted Bundy or whomever, right? Like, they've had enough time in the sun. It's time we focus on those people who survived.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we do. We so often want to glamorize and look at the offenders, and all true crime people are guilty of that, right? Where we talk about and we look at the offender. But it's interesting, because if we do focus on those survivors and those survivor stories, right? There's no shame in being the victim, right? When people say, like, oh no, like, why are we, do you call yourself a victim? You are, but that's not all that you are, right? So victimhood is one experience and one chapter of what you are. But then there's life after victimhood, right? And there's life during victimhood that doesn't get minimized, right? Like, I got a PhD while being in an abusive relationship, right? So it's like, I have life happening, and that part was simultaneous with the abuse. And so it's so interesting that when someone hears the word victim, right, there's automatically like this downplay, kind of like you're somehow damaged or worthless or like trash. Do you know what I mean? We really do start thinking of people like this, and we forget that crime happens to every person that's colorblind, right? When we talk about domestic violence, very wealthy people, very intelligent people, you know, every gender, every sexuality. I don't care if you're a pastor or a Boy Scout leader or whatnot. There's no family exempt from these kinds of dark things that happen in our homes. And so I just really encourage people to rethink the way they kind of respond when they hear that word victim, because what we forget is, when we talk at the dinner table, out at a restaurant, there's probably many a survivors that sit alongside us that we would have never known. Jules, I didn't know that until I think months into us working, right? That you were a sexual abuse survivor. And I thought, like, whoa. And people go, like, I don't know if I should share that. People might judge. Your elevated status went up to here, where I went, like, she gets it. And she has this drive and energy that's going to bring such hope to people. It was all positive, right? Where I went, yep, of course she is, because she's a survivor. And, you know, it just, I want survivors to start rethinking that, right? Where it's not a shameful thing. Like, should I expose this or not? Yes, it's your story. You own it. And hopefully when we start owning those stories, people will start thinking differently about those words, right? And start kind of responding in a way that's healthy for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that true crime needs to change. It needs to evolve. It needs to grow. I think we need to move past the sensationalism. We need to move past the victim blaming. We need to move past the romanticizing of perpetrators and the sexualizing of perpetrators. We need to move beyond that. You know, I don't have a problem with people being fascinated by abnormal psychology, being fascinated by the macabre. Like, that's fine. What I have a problem with is when people take the worst day in somebody's life and they twist it and turn it into something that's more entertaining, because they're going to get more ads, because they're going to get more views, because it might go viral. And it's at the expense of people's pain. Yes. And so if you're a true crime fan, I'm a true crime fan, okay? But if you're a true crime fan, I really ask that you vote with your conscience about who you're listening to, mm-hmm. about what you're watching, mm-hmm. because those are the things that are going to make the biggest difference. We need to democratize true crime and change it into something with empathy, something with kindness, something that honors and respects the people that have survived and those that are left behind.
Eric, I think what you were alluding to a little bit was also this idea of the valuable victim, right? And how the media loves to do one of two things. They like to find the case where you have this amazing, beautiful picture of perfection. And we're going to cover that case and give all of this attention to cases like that. Also, they deserve attention. Maddie McCann, right? You have this innocent little girl. She's a little white girl with blonde hair, right? And she fits this innocent, valuable victim, right? Wealthy family, Caucasian, little girl. So there's this elevation of her story where there's cases, you know, of African-American men getting murdered and their story's not covered. I remember a mom saying one time, like, this is the story my son got, right? It was a 1-inch by 1-inch, like, man murdered, blah, blah, blah. And she said, and they used his mugshot from 6 years ago when they could have asked me for a picture of my son, right? A criminal picture of my murdered son, right? So, and then we also have this idea of when we can pick holes in that perfect mm-hmm. victim, we like to do that. And Jules and I don't think there's been a case yet where I'm like, God bless, I'm grateful they did not look into, you know, every single second and action of myself. Yeah, because you could pick out so many things, right, in my life that isolated, removed from context, right, no understanding of who I am as an actual human being, I could look horrific because you would take a sentence out of a book and say that you knew who I was, right? So if you think about, like, I've made many a mistakes in my life with grief, with trauma, with motherhood, and thank God those are not all recorded and exposed, right? Because I'm a good human, but I make mistakes because I'm human. And so I think we do that in true crime, right? We say she was drinking at 20, she was smoking weed at 21. Like, well, that's what happens when you lie down with dogs, you get fleas. And it's like, I'm a professor. 80% of the students that I'm working with right now are having the best time of their life and putting themselves in incredibly dangerous situations with the best intentions of hoping the people around them protect them because they're in very dangerous situations.
Mm-hmm. So on this note, I would like to read something that Julie Murray sent me. I see Julie Murray's here. Hi, Julie.
Oh, Julie. I love Julie. So, Julie's another warrior. I love her.
She is. So she, on the talk of victim blaming, like, you know, she's experienced it with her sister, Maura. So I really wanted to kind of just read a couple paragraphs of her experience because it really ties into exactly what we're talking about here. So she said, I first learned of my missing 21-year-old little sister's alleged wild sex orgies from a blogger online. The blogger's source for the alleged gangbangs were three unnamed men who later would become prominent businessmen. Interesting word choice, hoisting up the three prominent businessmen on a pedestal, all while using my voiceless missing sister as a proverbial doormat for some salacious clickbait. Disgusting. It saddens me that my family tragedy is used in such a manner. Maura would be absolutely mortified knowing the depths people are willing to go for a good story. The exploitation of my missing sister cannot be reversed. It is everlasting. To me, she is not a character in a book. She was my little sister, a human being deserving of basic human decency and dignity. It sickens me to know certain bottom feeders in the true crime community would go as far as using hearsay and conjecture as a standard for sourcing to exploit a missing woman. This community can do better. Do better. Thank you,
yes.
Julie.
Yes, Julie. Thank you so much. And that's a whole nother conversation we could be having about sexualization and women, right? And mm-hmm. how as a woman, I'm somehow supposed to be ashamed that I'm a sexual being just like my male counterparts are, right? And that there's two different standards. It's 2021, thank God. But a lot of these cases we talk about are from the 80s and, you know, 90s and these kinds of things. And we're still at 2021 in a really, you know, prehistoric phase. But it is, it's this idea that if she had premarital sex somehow, then of course murder was the next thing, right? Or sexual assault. If she had given it up, then people can take it. And it's horrific that those are the kinds of conversations that you see very frequently when you talk about sexual assault, when you talk about murder, right? And especially when you have a female victim or a gay or lesbian victim, a transgender victim, somehow a gender identity or sexuality becomes permission to then sexually take advantage of someone or to take, you know, their life or something to that extent. So the conversation is changing. You have people like Eric, you have people like Jules who are getting on this platform of saying, I will forever make sure that I try. Right. I remember when we did our podcast about Mara, my, and Eric about, you know, about baby Jacob, my biggest heart was like, I pray when they listen that I didn't disrespect in any way, right, the family, because the one thing I want is more visibility. And I want this permission to say, let go of the shame and blame and give yourself a chance to live beyond. You're not just Jacob's brother, right? Which you are Jacob's brother, but you're a million other things. And I remember telling Julie the same thing. Julie, don't be scared to be Julie too, right? And not just that identity of the surviving family yeah. member.
I would like to thank today's sponsor, Southwest Labs. Are you like me, and do you hate the hassle of having to call your doctor to schedule an appointment? That just drives me crazy. Well, guess what? There's an easier way, and it's called Southwest Labs. Southwest Labs makes medical testing super simple. You don't have to call your doctor to make an appointment and wait for 3 months. Southwest Labs offers a huge variety of tests, including STD testing, prostate screening, diabetes monitoring, COVID testing, and more. All you have to do is choose your test, get tested, and then you can get your results with a doctor's interpretation virtually. Southwest Labs has locations in Albuquerque and Las Cruces, and all you have to do is call 505-609-LABS or visit southwestlab.com. And even better, you can find Southwest Labs on social media at Southwest Lab for more information. Schedule a test today and mention this ad when you schedule your appointment. Take the hassle out of medical screening and take control of your health today with Southwest Labs.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think when you look at creators like Sarah Turney, who's here watching and commenting, you know, these are the people, and Dr. Jules, these are the people that are really doing their best to present these stories in the way that they deserve to be told. Mm-hmm. The humanization of the victims, the humanization of their families, coming from that empathetic lens is so critical, and it's very important to me. And I don't always get it perfectly right, you know, because I do make mistakes. I am human, but I give it my best and I try my best. And I wish that more creators would do better and try better, because it's hurtful. It's mm-hmm. hurtful. You know, the comment section aside, when you have big creators that are well known that do things like disrespect the wishes of the family by, you know, leaking information because it's going to make their story more appealing, and information that could damage a case, like, those things are horrifying and terrible, and it needs to stop.
Mm-hmm. It's really awful.
It's a rant, sorry.
That's not a rant, that's important.
No. And like, please let me go into really quickly, like, just so everybody watching can maybe kind of understand where this comes from and why we do this and what the research is suggesting. So going back to Niemi and Young, who've done a lot of research, they've done 4 studies as of 2016, spanning thousands and thousands of participants. And they found some really interesting things with regards to morals. So they found 2 different kinds of moral values. One is binding moral values, which is something that Ashley referenced earlier, where somebody who exhibits more binding moral values, which we exhibit both, but some people are going to exhibit more one or the other, or a community will. So you've got someone who exhibits more binding moral values. They'll see a victim as unclean and they deserve what they got. They don't view it through empathy. They view it as the collective, like, this brings shame. And a very good example of that is the case of Junko Furuta, where you've got these 4 young men who killed this young woman. And then later, after the fact, you've got the mother who's vandalizing the grave as if Junko brought this on herself. She is, you know, she was asking for this. She took away this woman's son, all of these sorts of things. And then you have individualizing moral values. So Somebody who expresses individualizing moral values is more likely to express empathy and see somebody as not damaged, but somebody as being a survivor or as a victim if they've been murdered, not like, oh, what could this person have done differently? So what we exhibit more of, be it, you know, binding moral values or individualizing moral values, is a really great indicator of how we're going to view, you know, kind of a narrative if we're going to blame a victim or if we're going to blame an offender.
And it gets really easy to get in that group think, right? Where when you hear that all the time, right? I don't want to be the one to like question, you know, is that right? So when you're so used to hearing, you know, women who are sexually active are whores. And when you're used to hearing that, you know, people who get sexually assaulted are asking for it. And maybe, you know, children who are sexually abused, they somehow led on their offender. When you hear those narratives, right, it's a lot easier to just go like, oh, and you just kind of dive down into that, right? Instead of saying, wait a minute, again, right? We said this in the, Eric and I wrote this back this morning. I said, the abuser's responsible. That's it. That's who's responsible for that, right? And do we make mistakes as human beings? Yes. I pray to God every single person who records a true crime podcast, who watches a true crime show, sits back and says, on my worst day, or even sometimes on my best, if you took a quick snippet of who I am, you could paint me to be a monster. And I don't know that there's anything somebody does, right, that warrants hurting them and abusing them and murdering them, right? Like, what is it that led to that other than maybe protecting your family? But otherwise, it's like, I don't care how bad someone is. I don't care how, you know, someone doesn't believe the same morals you believe, has a different sexuality, a different race, whatever. None of that is permission to another human being to hurt them. And so I think things like this, us talking, some amazing podcasters and advocates right here, right, who are advocating this change of narrative, is what's needed, right? And the media, my God, they're the greatest tool we have. They are, and the worst monster on the face of this planet, because so many survivors especially know this in these cold cases. If I let the media die on this case, then I may never get a shot at justice. My loved one's voice goes away, right? But there's a cost to that, because then you are, like Eric said, you expose yourself to horrific comments, really bad, you know, coverage of the case and things that are just unethical. So I challenge media people. I talk to journalists a lot about, be careful the way you portray a victim, right? We're supposed to protect the victim in our stories. And you don't see that a lot when you have true crime journalism.
Yeah. You've got a great responsibility as a true crime podcaster, YouTuber, or whatever kind of, you know, platform that you use. I think exactly to what Eric had said earlier, it's fine to have a fascination with the abnormal, with abnormal psychology or the macabre. Yep. But there is a very fine line, and yeah, it's a gray area, but where we glorify the actions of somebody like Manson or Ted Bundy, Chris Watts, and we call him hot, rather than forgetting the fact that, like, you know, he murdered his wife and his kids, you know.
Right.
The thing is, when we feed into that, it's a really dangerous, slippery slope.
It is. It is. And it's so despicable and disgusting. You know, there are no throwaway people. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if people are struggling with mental health issues or drug addiction or
they're a prostitute or a sex worker. Yes. Yeah. A sex worker. Yeah. Yes.
None of those things justify hurting anybody. And one of the things I really want to see changed in the narrative that we have as a society is we need to stop saying that somebody was arrested for having sex with a minor.
Oh my God, it's not sex. Yes.
There's no such thing as having sex with a minor.
Yes, yes. It is sex rape. With an underage girl. Like,
it is sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. It is grooming. Mm-hmm. You know, there were comments in the YouTube video, Kendall Ray's video, that were saying things that, oh, his mom only left after he was hitting on her niece. Okay. First of all, he was not hitting on my cousin.
No, he was 14, grooming
her. He was grooming my cousin for sexual abuse.
Or when they say, oh, well, it's consensual. It's a 14-year-old. It's like, what are you talking about?
It had nothing to do with jealousy. My mom was not jealous that her husband was trying to sexually assault her niece. My mom thought that at that point, and you know, I hate to speak for her, but this is my understanding, is she thought that she was the only victim that was being hurt at the time. And so knowing that and feeling like she was protecting me from being hurt by taking everything from this person, when she noticed that my cousin was being victimized, that's when she put her foot down. Yep. Now, had she known that I was being victimized, she would have put her foot down, yes. Right? Mm-hmm. Had she known for sure that what was happening to Jacob was intentional, like I suspect, she would have put her foot down. But like you, we talked about early on, you know, it's a slow burn. He's wearing her down mentally. All of these things are happening, but please, please, please stop saying sex with a minor. Please stop calling grooming flirting. It's hurtful. It's disgusting. And it does nothing to deal with the issue of holding these people responsible for sexual abuse of minors.
Yeah. Okay. And don't put that when you're talking about the offender, don't discuss all the reasons he's great and then say, oh, he's this great coach. He's a great dad. He's a great this. And he's been arrested for sexual abuse. It's like, let's just talk about his, you know, right? This, and let's focus on how do we heal the community around us and the survivors that experience his abuse.
It's like what Julie Murray said, the fact that the three businessmen were called, you know, three prominent businessmen, where, you know, Maura was looked at as some vixen or something like that. Like, oh, she must have brought it on herself because of the choices that she made with three prominent businessmen. And you're elevating these people. And it's like, we do this, media does this all the time. It happens in true crime as well, where the person who should be looked at as this offender or perpetrator, they're looked at as, the Stanford rape scandal is another example where it was the star swimmer, the star whatever, the star athlete. We see it with all these rape scandals, right? They are not this rapist. They are a star athlete, a stellar student from a good family, all these other kind of mitigating, excusing, justifying things, qualifying statements. It's so wrong. And we need to switch that narrative.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Can we talk about real quick what happens if anyone who's watching might be in that kind of situation and ways that we can get help, right? Because like we talked about, one of the most critical times that a victim who's experiencing abuse has, right, is that very dangerous period of saying, can I get out? And that's what keeps a lot of people away. One of the things that is often encouraged is having that plan, right, of knowing, even if you don't think you're going to go anywhere, right, but knowing where shelters are located near you, right? And thinking like, I don't want to go to a shelter. Well, yeah, you don't have to stay at a shelter, but to get to a shelter and to mm-hmm. be safe, then you can start with professionals helping you plan to get out, right? Making sure you know, schedules and phone numbers, right? Let's say your phone got taken away or disconnected. Do you know phone numbers? Do you know how to get to right, a place that you could be safe. So planning becomes the number one thing you can do. And I remember, sit back and just think, right, if this was a best friend who was telling you what was happening to them, would you be okay with that, right? And I remember, because I think we allow ourselves to be treated in one way, and then when we witness someone else being hurt, it's not okay. It's not acceptable. It's a lot easier to see other people suffering. So I encourage people who are on that fence of saying, like, am I a victim of abuse? Because that's like, I don't want to be that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be that. You're going to be a survivor, but we got to get you in a healthy situation, right? So I always encourage people, ask yourself if your sister, if your best friend, if your daughter was calling to tell you, this is what's happening to me, would it be okay? Right? And if the answer is no, then you start having to sit back and plan. There's a lot of resources online. There's a lot of resources and shelters in many counties that can help. But that plan is critical in saying, if you're going to make that decision, you got to go. And it's scary and it's terrifying. But I really encourage people to start thinking about what resources they do have, who they do know, who's safe, and those types of situations. So,
yeah.
Those of us in that. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dr. Jules.
Oh, just those of us in those situations to reach out. Like, for one, there's often an element of denial when you're in a situation like that. To say it out loud is to make it real. It's almost like you brought it into reality. If you don't say it out loud, it didn't happen. I'm not abused if I don't say it out loud. So there's some, it takes an incredible amount of courage for somebody to come forward and say to a friend, a family member, a priest, whatever, to say, I've been abused and I need help. So if somebody does come to you with that sort of revelation, please be ready to act. Please be ready to intervene. Please be ready to help, because the situation is critical at that point.
And often help in the way the survivor is asking you to help, right? And this is from sexual abuse to any kinds of other things, right? But to say, you know, our first response is like, well, we're calling the police. We're getting you out of there. Like, I'm going to kill him, right? Or her, right? Whoever's hurting you. But you also have to, if someone does, like Jules said, very few people disclose abuse to somebody, right? Even to their family, even to their best friends. And so if
even
they
to
do,
themselves.
Even to themselves, that's why I have to, I have to do the best friend test. You know, I got to go like, if my best friend called up and said like, oh, he told me I'm a worthless fat cow and he pushed me down the stairs. Like, that's not okay. Right. Like, we're going to need to address that. But then, you know, someone in it goes like, yeah, but I was mouthing off, you know, I should have kept my mouth shut and I should have done this and that. But if they do say to you, this is what's happening, it's your place to listen and to support and to not question. The one thing we always want to do is we want to say, oh, tell me what happened. Like, where did he touch you? And what did he do? And what did she do to you? Right. Let them tell you in their own time. They've disclosed the abuse. That's enough. And you say, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I believe you. How can I help? And that's it. And when they have details that they're comfortable sharing, they will. When they know how they want help, they can tell you that, right? So it's a lot about giving that control back to a survivor and saying, I'm here. And when you say I'm here, mean it. And then saying, okay, then we're going to do this together. And you tell me how I'm going to help you do that.
You've got to let a survivor frame their own narrative, right?
Yeah. And also, I think another important thing to consider for true crime fans that are watching and that are listening to the recording of this, you know a fraction of this person's story. You know probably maybe that much, maybe even less than that. So it's easy to say, well, if I was in the situation, I would have done X, Y, Z. Oh, I would never let that happen to me. You have no idea what other factors are in play. Okay. So I want people to just think about that when they're listening to these stories. And also be aware of the speaker's unconscious bias that is coming through, because people will narrate towards a certain direction without even realizing it. I do it myself. Yep. It happens. That kind of thing is easy to get swayed into and sucked into and believing, and then the speculation and all these other things that are horrible. I'm so grateful to both of you for being here to talk through this with me, because it's something that's been bothering me for a very long time.
It should have.
I just want everyone to change the way that they think about this. You know, when I was sitting down with my friend Edna, we were at a restaurant. We were talking about Jacob's case for the first time. She is a former prosecutor in New Mexico. She is an incredible person. Edna, if you're watching, I love you. Thank you so much for all that you've done to help me with Jacob's case. But she said something to me that shocked me. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I believe it's episode number 2 about Jacob on my podcast. She said, we were in this busy restaurant. It was really loud. It was before COVID. So nobody was wearing a mask. It's kind of weird to think about that. But anyway, she said, Eric, look around in this restaurant. Pretty much everybody in this restaurant has been touched by domestic violence.
1,000%.
And just as many, if not more, are probably perpetrators of domestic violence. And that shocked me. And she's like, this is the problem with our society, is because we don't talk about it, because we don't listen to people who are telling us their stories. We don't believe that it's possible for it to be such a pervasive issue, but it is.
Scary. It's scary if it's that pervasive, right? Oh, that could happen to me. That could happen to someone I love. It doesn't. It has, right? So people that say it can't, I'm going, I guarantee you someone in your family is affected by this, right? And you're probably coexisting with someone who hasn't told you what's happened or hasn't identified what's happening to them. So I do encourage people listening that language matters so much, so much, and be willing to learn to change. I just made a mistake in this podcast, right? By using the wrong term for a sex worker. And it's like, that's just an ingrained term that I'm going like, oops. And every time I say it, I'm human. And it's like, I'm learning. And so I don't want to contribute to those problems, but it takes vulnerability to say, I did not know that. Let me change my language. Let me try to be a better, safer person, right? And not being ashamed to make mistakes and to have dialogues that are tough, right? Because there are people who need your voice. They need you to be an ally and an advocate and those types of things. And it's often people you had no idea, right? You're talking to people, you share your own story, you share a case you're interested in, and someone you've known for years says, you know, that happened to me when I was younger. You know, I grew up in a home like that. And you're going, what? And it shouldn't be surprising because it is so common, but watch your language, be vulnerable, be willing to learn and say, how am I a better advocate for the people I love and care about? Because you have been, right? Someone very close to you has been impacted by some type of crime.
I think opening up and starting a dialogue, right, is super important. The fact that we're talking about this now, we're talking about it with, you know, an element of transparency. I was comfortable sharing my own story of childhood sexual abuse because Eric first shared his. Mm-hmm. So you got this, you open up a dialogue, you start talking about it, and you destigmatize these things. 1 in 4 women, the statistics show, which statistics aren't always wholly accurate, but women or men, you know, will experience domestic violence. This is a pervasive problem in society. We need to destigmatize it, and we need to continue to talk about it and normalize these conversations, right?
And I will tell you, for Eric, you speaking, and I know I say it a lot, and you're like, oh my gosh, stop. But it's like, to have a male survivor say, I will tell my story, and I will tell it vulnerable. I will tell it loud. I will tell it bold. I can't tell you how many times I've Googled as a professor, like, I just need to find a man's story to share with my class, because it's not just women, right? Little boys and girls exist in homes, right? And little boys and girls are affected by all of these crimes. And whether, the wife often gets abused more than the husband, maybe, but there's babies watching that, right? And there's babies that are being affected by that, and babies are boys and girls, right? And the fact that the LGBTQ community needs louder voices and advocates and platforms to speak about their abuse, right? And that same-sex couples have an incredibly high rate of domestic violence that happens in their homes. But again, what we do is we say, I'm going to close that door on that community, because like, that's not us. We don't do that. Like, well, that's, you know, we decide who's valuable enough to fight for. Humans are valuable enough to fight for. So as a community, whether you're the podcaster, the fan, right? And I think Jules and I have said this a couple of times, if you really love these cases and you love true crime, same amount, go out and find someone like, you know, Justice for Baby Jacob and these kinds of things. Find organizations that are advocating for the families who live this much longer than the 1 hour episode you just listened to, right? They live it every day, every moment. That's their reality. And the media has made it 20 times worse. So make sure you're reaching out to those organizations and causes to say, I'm going to give back to true crime, right? And actually help those who are affected.
That's so important. And I think it's really important that people just take inventory of where you are in this equation. Are you contributing to the good part of true crime, or are you contributing to the dark side of true crime? You know, Sarah talked about her mom being victim blamed by a very prominent true crime person. That's disgusting to me. One of the things that hurts a lot, and people don't necessarily mean it to hurt when they say it, but when people say things to me like, Eric, I tried really hard. I just can't listen to your brother's story because it's too awful. And I get that it is awful. It's terrible. Imagine living it is my reaction to those people, right? Imagine how awful it is to have to live that story, not just to have to listen to it. So the reason that we can't, you know, I could speak up, Dr. Jules could speak up, you could speak up, Dr. Ashley, about your past abuse. If people are unwilling to hear it, it's not going to make a difference.
But there's survivors that are silent, and there's people suffering in silence that do hear us. And there's people that will never listen, but there's people that need the voice. They need somebody to say, like, it's not just me. Wait, there's a beautiful woman in Malaysia who, like, no way she also did this, right? There's a brilliant guy who has, like, this really successful podcast. And wait, as a kid, he was sexually abused? Like, what? So I think I think as much as there's always going to be people who won't listen, right? One of the things I do challenge people is push those boundaries of what you'll listen to, because that's where we change. And when we're uncomfortable, that's when really magical things happen. But anyone who's willing to share their story, which is often so hard to tell, it's often so hard to hear, right? There will always be an ear that's going to hear that and go, oh my God, that's it. You know, one person, that story changed my life. Okay, well, then that's exactly why I told it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So even though there's always going to be 10 lining up that don't want to hear, that are nasty, there might be one at the back of that line that says, I needed that. And I heard it and I got out, you know, I survived. I didn't hurt myself. Right.
Look at the comments, right? Like, look at the comments. God, we're seeing, so right? Like, they're amazing. Everybody who's here, so brave and like sharing their personal experiences. And those are the people that, you know, we're reaching with this conversation. And like you said, there might be 10 people that don't want to hear it. That it's too sad. It's too difficult. I don't want to hear about stuff with kids or domestic violence. Those are the people that, you know, we may never reach, but it's those people that are looking for somebody to tell their story. They're looking for somebody to frame a narrative that, you know, they can kind of understand. And they're going, yes, that's what I'm experiencing. That's my life. And then maybe that person will then have the courage to go and talk to somebody about it.
That's exactly right, Jules. So literally, like I told you guys, I was studying this, right? I was literally getting my PhD in victimology. And I'm like working with families. And I'm like, oh, thank God, I don't know any of that. Do you know what I mean? And then I'm like, oh my God, I'm living in an abusive relationship. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I started listening, reading, right, looking at different things, I was grateful to hear stories where I went, that happens in my home. Like, okay, right. And so I finally got the bravery to say, like, I'm going to label it, I'm going to get out of it, and I'm going to create a beautiful life. And I mean, I had a beautiful chapter with my late husband, Buddy. I have a beautiful daughter, right? I lost him, and we're going to just keep finding beautiful chapters. But it's like, I will forever be impacted. I was a better partner, right? People are like, I don't want to leave this. I'll never be loved again. My ex told me, you will never be loved again. You're unlovable. Like, you're the problem in this relationship. Boy, was I loved. I was loved more than probably 99% of listeners. I was loved so hard after that asshole, right? By an angel. So it's like, I was scared of that. I remember saying, I'm going to be a just like broken human that is worthless and valueless, because that's what abuse does. So such a lie, right? It's such a lie. You get to create new chapters every time something awful happens, right? You get to write the next narrative. And so if you're scared that you'll never be loved again, you'll never have someone there for your children, you'll never have somebody, right, who steps up and is there for you, not true. You just need the right person to do that, right? And you need to be healthy enough. I was a better partner to Buddy because I had known what it was like to be hurt. Right. And so there's hope and joy that comes after trauma too. So don't be scared of that as well if you're a survivor listening.
Yeah, it's my hope. And I'll go around. We'll close out here with some final thoughts. I don't think that we have enough time to get to everything we want to talk about. So we might have to have a follow-up to this conversation. But I want to say that, you know, I'm not coming on here to start a fight with people. You know, I'm not coming on here to do anything other than to hopefully bring some awareness to a different perspective, a different way of looking at things. And I really hope that this was a helpful conversation for people. And I hope that me telling my story is going to impact people in a positive way, because it's not something that I've enjoyed doing. It's not been fun for me. I've had to go back into therapy to deal with all of the residual trauma that's coming up as a result of having these conversations. And so I hope and I pray that this is helpful to somebody, and that my story is helpful to somebody, even if I never get justice for my brother, even if there's never justice for what happened to me and for what happened to my mom, if this helps one person, then it's worth it for me. I want to thank both of you. I'll start with Dr. Jules. Closing thoughts.
This was such an important and timely conversation. I think switching the narrative in true crime, like you said, it's okay to be obsessed with the dark. That is very much inherently what it means to be human. We're obsessed with death and with darkness. But I do think with regards to true crime, we need to take a responsible approach where we're always considering the families. The families listen to these stories. And are you okay with the family hearing the way that you portrayed either victims or survivors in this story? And if the answer is no, then you need to consider the approach that you're taking.
Yeah. Dr. Well, Ashley.
Yeah. I just encourage anyone listening. I'm just blown away. If you guys have seen me down here, I'm just blown away by the listeners' responses, right? And people being so vulnerable and transparent. Remember the power of your voice. And I encourage anybody who has experienced abuse, who has experienced trauma, to just give yourself grace and kindness. Let the shame go. The shame is the offenders, right? What you have and what you possess is now this story and the legacy. And like Eric said, it's painful to talk about. It is. I don't want to talk about abuse, right? I've got a lot of beautiful things I'd like to share, but I have to be transparent because that's part of my story. And I think it makes me a better woman, a better friend, a better partner, those types of things. When I say, this is all of me. I don't have to say that didn't happen, right? If this is all of me. So I encourage you guys to let the shame go, to say that you're, you know, look in the mirror and say, I'm valuable. I'm lovable, right? I'm strong. Eric, when you said like, I had to go back to therapy, it's like, hell yeah, you did. I love therapy, right? Yes, that's a sign of strength and intelligence, right? You get that therapist, you get a professional to help you because you're worth it and because your story's important, right? And Eric, like you said, if I change one person's life, you've changed hundreds, if not thousands. You allowed Jules to feel safe to share her story. Now I felt safe enough to share my story. And look at the comments. So like you keep doing it, but don't forget when you do put yourself out there, always take that time for self-care, right? And make sure that you say, I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to own my story. I'm going to put it out there. But then sometimes I got to unplug and I got to make sure that I refuel so that I can be a voice again for people who need me. So thank you for having me. I'm so grateful to everyone who listened and just for being this is all from COVID and being bold enough to be like, hey, I'm on Twitter now. And like, look at these connections. This is so great. So one good thing to come out of COVID is these beautiful relationships and beautiful people. So thanks for having us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. And so I normally close this out by saying thanks for listening and stay safe, New Mexico. But my audience has gotten so much bigger than that now. So thanks for listening and stay safe, Earth.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to True Consequences. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at True Consequences Pod and on Twitter at True Cons Pod. True Consequences is listener supported. If you'd like to support this one-man show, please go to patreon.com/trueconsequences. Thanks for listening and stay safe, New Mexico.